Joseph, it's a pleasure to have you with me today. Can you start off by just giving the listeners a brief sketch of your background? Tell us who you are.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, my background academically is actually in a branch of theology called patristics, and that deals with a lot of ancient texts and languages and so on and so forth. But I've always kind of had an interest in physics as well and in history, particularly World War II. So I guess all these interests just kind of come together in the way in the way I write these books.
Right. Now, your educational background includes some studies at Oxford. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's where I did my doctorate. Yeah.
I was particularly fascinated by the fact that while at Oxford, you were able to get a pretty good overview and an understanding of how to handle their library, and the library contains books that go back into the, 1400s, 1500s?
Oh, yeah. Well, Oxford has been a copyright library in the United Kingdom for, you know, many centuries, so the library is actually very huge, and one of the difficulties in using that library there is that they don't really have a catalog system. They have these big ledger books in which they fill everything out by hand, you know, and it's sort of alphabetized, so you kind of have to find your way around there.
Okay, so in your books, and particularly in your latest book, The Philosopher's Stone, which I'm sure we'll get to at some future date, you were actually able to go back and find manuscripts and writings that go back through the 20th century all the way back to 15th or 14th century, correct?
Well, yeah. When I was there, Jim, I took occasion not only to visit the Bodleian Library there in Oxford, but, I visited the British Museum down in London and took advantage of the collection at the Ashmolean Museum there. And a lot of the texts that I examined, you know, I never thought I'd be able to use, but fortunately somebody has put a lot of them online on the Internet. So a lot of the stuff that I remember seeing over there is now available on the Internet, so that's kind of why I chose to write The Philosopher's Stone.
So when you say the Ashmolean Museum, you're talking about a museum dedicated to Elias Ashmole, right?
Right, yes,
who
absolutely.
Was an early-day ranking Freemason.
Oh, yes, and a member of the Royal Society, the whole nine yards.
Right. So now we're getting into Nazi International, because this underground stream of knowledge, that passed through Freemasonry and through France and Britain and Italy, seemed to kind of culminate in the occultism that has been attributed to Hitler's Nazi party. Let's go back to prior to World War II, when and even prior to the creation of the Nazi party, which, just for the benefit of the listeners, I think we should point out, Nazi is the German acronym for Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, which means the National Socialist German Workers' Party.
Right.
So we are really not, you know, everybody gets the idea of a Nazi. That's a German in a black uniform and shiny boots goose-stepping down the street, right?
Yeah,
but that's not necessarily true. A Nazi is a national socialist. That's someone who wants to practice centralized authority through a socialist system, but confine it to a national boundary.
Right.
Okay. So now, even before the Nazis came to power, there was a great interest in, we say, occult. In other words, hidden paranormal type activity. Joseph, in your studies, do you believe that the Germans at some point recovered a physical spaceship or a UFO, or do you believe that they perhaps made contact through more psychic means?
Well, there are stories out there, Jim, as you well know, that the Nazis supposedly recovered a craft somewhere that crashed in the Black Forest, or in, depending on the version, you hear versions that will say that it crashed around the region of the Harz Mountains in Thuringia. I've never really been able to document that to my satisfaction. And by the same token, you do hear stories that the Nazis used in their early secret society days, before they were even really an organized political party, that they used mediums to contact off-world intelligences and so on and so forth. And the problem I have with those rumors is that they all come from a very narrow circle of neo-Nazis that were active in and around Vienna and then southern Germany after the war, publishing through the 50s and early 60s. So when I approach this subject, I tend to try and stick to the known terrestrial and corroborative stories that I can, or documents that I can actually corroborate. So I tend to shy away from, you know, crashed and back-engineered vehicles and channeled mediums and so on and so forth. I don't doubt for a moment that the Nazis had an interest in the occult and that they would have tried such experiments, but the difficulty is getting a hold of verification from independent sources that would verify some of these stories that the post-war neo-Nazis are putting out.
So in other words, we don't really know.
Well, yeah, that's right. We don't really know. I hold open the possibility more for the activities of the Nazis being involved in those kind of occult things than I do for the stories about crashed and back-engineered craft. I've found very, very little evidence to substantiate that.
Right, and of course we do know that about the remote viewing experimentation,
right,
and operational use within the CIA and the United States Army in recent years.
Right.
Okay, but there's really no question, though, that the Germans, during the war, came up with some really cutting-edge, almost fabulous technology. I was kind of surprised to find out that the 1936 Olympics was televised. Thousands of Germans watched closed-circuit television.
Well, that's true. The Germans actually brought over the American inventor Philo Farnsworth. Some of the listeners may be familiar with that name. He was kind of an electrical engineering genius, and he had patented throughout the 20s most of the technology that made television possible. Well, the Nazis brought him over to Germany, and he gave them a lot of his patents under license, so the Germans were able to televise that 1936 Berlin Olympics. You know, when you stop and think about it, the first major televised sporting event in the world was being done in Nazi Germany, of all places.
Wow. And I believe in your book, Nazi International, you actually describe how towards the end of the war they were actually using television as a guidance system for rockets.
Well, yeah, you and I both spoke at the recent Laughlin UFO conference, and I put up on the presentation there, I put up some slides, some actual television photo slides of one of these German television-guided missiles being tested on what looks like an old derelict ship in I think about March of 1945. And, you know, it's really kind of uncanny because it's like watching a 1945 version of the first Gulf War, you know, when we're watching all those smart bombs slam into Iraqi bunkers, because that's exactly what you see. But this is 1945, not 1991. So.
It's amazing. So I guess the big critical question here is, do you believe that the Germans had some sort of outside help, whether it's through psychic means or whether it's through crash UFO? Do you think they had outside help in developing some of this exotic technology, or were they just real smart guys?
Well, I lean towards terrestrial roots, as you know, as a basis of explaining most of these things. I think that there are basically three things to look at, or pardon me, three streams, really, to examine when you approach this subject. The first would be the writings taking place in the 20s and 30s in terms of theoretical physics, most of it being published in Germany. And those things would concern unified field theories, you know, all the way from Kaluza up to Albert Einstein's early theories. And then there's an engineering component, and to me this is the most fascinating, and I do try and discuss it in a book of mine called Secrets of the Unified Field, but basically to give you kind of a Cliff Notes version of that. There was a Hungarian electrical engineering genius. His name is not very well known to most people. His name is Gabriel Krohn. And in 1935, he publishes a paper that wins him the Montefiore Prize from the University of Liège in Belgium. Now, in this paper, Jim, what he does is he basically says that some of these 20s and 30s unified higher dimensional field theories that try and unify gravity and electromagnetism are actually the theories that can be used to explain anomalies that electrical engineers at that time were very familiar with in large networked rotating electrical systems. Now, if you stop and think about what he's really said, the implication of that is he's saying that with 1935's technology, we can engineer space-time locally on the laboratory bench. Now, across the border, yeah, that's a whopper. That's a real whopper. And it's very interesting to me that it's right about this time that you see all publication of unified field theories inside of Germany stop. It's like the switch has been turned off. You know, there's no more public work being done. But I suspect
kind of like the early 50s when there were articles about anti-gravity being
exactly so.
In the United States, and then it just stopped.
Exactly so. It's exactly the same sort of thing that we see taking place. And of course, the Germans would have figured out that, you know, if this is an engineerable type of theory, then yes, it's going to lead to field propulsion, anti-gravity, free energy, and doomsday weapons all at once.
So in other words, the Germans early on simply went off on a whole different tact as far as physics goes. This is Jim Mars for Dreamland, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Dreamland. Serious wonder spoken here.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars back again here on Dreamland with Joseph P. Farrell discussing the Nazi International.
If there's outside help in developing some of this physics, I think we have to look to the German interest and particularly the SS interest in esoteric and occult matters. And it's very interesting to me that Himmler, if you can stop and imagine Heinrich Himmler having a fellow that's called Himmler's Rasputin, you know, but he did.
They're like Rasputin having a Rasputin.
Yes, that's exactly right. This guy's name is Carl Maria Villigut. And what Villigut actually believed was that the whole cosmos originated out of basically the opposition forces between two counter-rotating systems, okay? Now, I find that extremely interesting that this well-known occultist at the time would have thought that, because it's exactly that principle of counter-rotation and torsion and so on and so forth that you see being employed in the Nazi Bell device. And what's really intriguing to me is that if you look at the swastika itself, as you know, the kind of the corporate logo of the Nazi Party, if you look at that as kind of a vector diagram, what you really see in the swastika is a system of rotational stress, if you look at it like a physicist would. And that's exactly the kind of physics that the Nazis are developing during this whole period. So in other words, the occult influence
may have represented their view of centrifugal physics.
Yes, absolutely. It's an ideogram of this rotational physics.
Well, now you've brought us to one of my favorite subjects, the Nazi Bell. of course, we know that towards the end of the war, the Germans had all kinds of fantastic stuff. They were building the V-1 rocket, the Buzz Bomb, the V-2 rocket. They were building a three-stage rocket. They developed the first operational jet fighter, the Messerschmitt
262.
And perhaps even the fireballs, yeah, the little fireball things that went up and tried to interfere with the electrical systems of our bombers. So, but tell everybody about the Bell. Just describe what we have here and how you think it worked and what you think it did.
Well, very briefly, to give you kind of a Cliff Notes version, the Bell was Nazi Germany's most highly classified secret weapons research project. It was classified Kriegsentscheidend, which translates as war decisive. Now, this is a classification, Jim, that's higher than the Nazi atom bomb, which I believe also was a very successful project. Now, that gives you an idea of the kind of physics that the Nazis saw in it. And in a nutshell, I believe that they were trying to investigate three things with this device. They were first of all trying to come up with a technology for free energy. And secondly, they were trying to come up with a technology for advanced field propulsion. And it's very interesting that some of the concentration camp inmates that lived and worked on this project and lived at Gross Rosen concentration camp described seeing barrel-like devices ascending and descending above the tree lines at night, glowing kind of a pale blue glow. So I definitely think the Germans had achieved a great deal of success with this device. The problem was that they were not able to mitigate or alleviate the very, very severe and even deadly field effects that it had. So in other words, they brought this technology to a certain pitch, but it was not yet a practical technology in the sense that you could have human beings fly, you know, climb into it and fly it around. So
well,
I think
that sounds amazingly similar to the stories we hear about the infamous Philadelphia experiment.
Oh yes, yeah. This is the other part of this story, because Gabriel Krohn, the fellow I mentioned earlier, comes over to this country and goes to work for General Electric. And of course, if you dig around long enough, you'll find that General Electric was involved, or some say was involved, in the Philadelphia experiment. And the
it could have been a continuation of this science.
Oh yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The only difference, I think, between the two experiments, the Germans had rationalized this Bell device very, very carefully. They put a great deal of thought into it. I think the Philadelphia experiment we put some thought into, but when we actually performed the experiment, I don't think we were expecting the results that we got.
They just said, hey, turn it on, let's see what happens.
Yeah, turn it on, let's see what happens.
Now, let's go back to the Bell. What happened to the Nazi Bell?
Okay, well, that's the Pandora's box, because in the book, The Nazi International, that just came out last year.
Which is not that long ago. That's only 2 months ago.
Well, yeah, it's 2 months ago. Right. But I came to the conclusion that there was a very, very odd project going on in Argentina after the war. And it involved a Nazi scientist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter. And the funny thing about this project was being conducted in secret up until the point that Juan Perón held a press conference in 1951 and told the world that Argentina had discovered the secret of the hydrogen bomb, okay? And then he trots out Dr. Richter, who proceeds to tell the Argentine press, yeah, I've learned how to control thermonuclear fusion. Well, he's roundly denounced, Jim, in all the world press, in Time magazine, New York Times, just everybody thinks this is pure crackpottery, okay?
Kind of like the same thing that happened back in the 90s when they announced they had developed cold fusion.
Exactly the same thing. Now, as I got to digging, I discovered when I got the man's paperclip file from the National Archives, that some 5 years after this press conference, the U.S. Air Force is investigating this man to the hilt. And they want to find out from him, they even have the attaché down there in Buenos Aires go to Richter and interview him. And Richter tells them, yeah, I began to notice these funny things about plasmas when I was doing research in 1936. Okay. And what Richter actually says, in no uncertain terms, is that in his plasma research, he discovered that when you put a plasma into rotation and then shock it, okay, stress it, that you get an anomalous return of energy. And for him, he thinks this is coming from, and these are his words, the zero-point energy, okay? Now, when I began to investigate this project even more, I discovered that Perón had set up a commission, a scientific commission, and appointed a bunch of Argentine scientists to go to Richter's labs and just find out, you know, just what the dickens is this guy really doing.
Well, yeah, because after all the so-called authorities in the world were going, oh, that can't be true, he had to know, right?
Right, exactly. So when they go up and have Richter perform some of his experiments, Richter just suddenly begins to behave like a complete goofball. He forgets to turn on his measuring equipment, or he'll locate it behind radioactive shielding where it does him absolutely no good whatsoever. And this happens over and over and over again. So in other words, Richter is behaving like someone who's been ordered to shut the project down by any means possible and make himself look silly. But when I dug a little bit further, I even discovered pictures of these large metal drums at some of his old laboratories there in Argentina. Now, this is what really threw me for a loop, because if you recall, the Bell Project involves two internal counter-rotating drums. I even have pictures of these drums in the Nazi International. Now, here's the kicker, Jim. Richter's equipment was supplied to him by the AEG, or Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, in Germany, which is kind of their General Electric, and that's the same company that built the power plant for the Bell. And there's one more little tidbit, and that is that Richter himself, when he worked in Germany, worked for the AEG company on a project called Charité Anlage, okay? And that was the project code name for the power plant to the Bell.
Wow, so the Bell, after the war, may have moved to Argentina.
Exactly.
Where the same guy had been working on it, worked on it again.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And isn't it true that he was, this experiments were all going on in the vicinity of a town called Bariloche?
Yes. All of these experiments were being conducted on Waymo Island, which is about 6 miles south, I think, about south-southwest of San Carlos de Bariloche. Now, where is that?
Yeah, well, first, let's tell everybody what the significance of Bariloche is.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. It's about 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires. Now, here's the rub. Within 100 miles, if you take a compass and draw a circle of about 100 miles radius from San Carlos to Bariloche, there is a large compound there called the Estancia, the ranch, okay? This was a compound that encompassed, I think, about 10,000 square miles. In other words, an area about the size of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The Germans, the Nazis, had bought this land prior to and during the war. And after the war, this is where Richter's project is more or less headquarters. And incidentally, Argentine intelligence places Martin Bormann in that area at the time that Richter's project is being shut down.
And we're talking about 1951.
Yes, sir. We're talking about 1951. So the implication is there's an organized Nazi extraterritorial state conducting its own independent research. It has its own funds, and they're continuing to investigate this exotic physics that they were tinkering around with during the war.
Okay, now let's tie that into the Bormann financial empire. Can you touch on that briefly, starting, say, with the, well, I'll set the stage. In June of 1944, the Allies invaded Normandy in France,
right,
gained a foothold, and
right,
by August it was clear that the Germans were not going to be able to push us off the beach. So in August, there was a big meeting held between Martin Bormann, deputy to Hitler, the guy who is actually running the show, and Hermann Schmitz, the head of the IG Farben Combine, and Dr. Abbs, who was head of the German Central Bank, and
right,
they decided to initiate Aktion Adlerflug, or Operation Eagle Flight. So
right,
tell us about Eagle Flight and how that ties in with the Bell.
Well, Eagle Flight is Bormann's strategic evacuation plan, okay? And I outlined this plan in the Nazi International. What he did was he basically told German corporations that they were going to turn over to the Nazi Party, in other words, to him, all of their liquid foreign cash reserves. And in return, Bormann and the party would fund them after the war. But he insisted that each of these corporations set up their own kind of little foreign research offices, and these would all be staffed with Nazi Party liaison officers answerable directly to Bormann. So what Bormann effectively did was he confiscated all of the corporate assets of Nazi Germany and began transferring them, not just liquid cash, but patents, documents, personnel, equipment outside of Nazi Germany, mostly to Latin America.
This is Jim Mars for Dreamland, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online with guest host Jim Mars.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars back again here on Dreamland with Joseph P. Farrell discussing the Nazi International. I think I should point out here, too, that at that point, the Nazis, this was not relegated solely to Germany. At that point, Nazis controlled all of Europe.
That's right.
And so we're talking about the assets from Italy, France. Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, yeah, you name it.
Exactly. Now, to give you an extent of the power of this organization, the financial power, Paul Manning, who was a CBS journalist and an associate of the old journalist Ed Murrow, people may remember him, kind of the pre-Walter Cronkite Walter Cronkite. Well, Paul Manning discovered that Martin Bormann had cashed a check as late as 1967 over his own signature drawn on Manufacturers Hanover and Chase Manhattan Bank, and the check was cleared by Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires. Okay? So in other words, at some point, this Nazi International struck some sort of deal with the Anglo-American corporate banking elite that allowed the Nazis to basically loan them their funds, which of course I think, you know, you can kind of read between the lines here. But I think that that basically allowed those corporate interests to keep all of this cash off the books and expand their ledger credit entry making ability. And what Bormann gets in return is a certain amount of protection. But here's the problem, Jim. As you know as well as I do, when you're dealing with someone like Martin Bormann, you're dealing with someone who's, and I put it this way in the conference, who's like Dick Cheney without the warmth and charm. Eventually, all of those markers are going to come due, and you'd better be able to pay.
Right. Exactly. So this is why, of course, this is, well, what's amazing here, Joseph, is that you and I think you'll agree with this, we have been in touch, but only recently.
Right.
Basically, we started off and we followed the evidence, as any good reporter should do, and we ended up running parallel and coming and coming to the same conclusion.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. We keep backing into each other in our research.
Know.
That's right.
And when you follow this money trail, this scientific trail, this weapon trail, you end up in basically in the United States. And that's what led me to write my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, meaning that the United States is now the world's preeminent empire, and we're the new Reich because at the center of this is the Nazi International.
Yes, exactly. And this again is something that I try and outline in great detail in the book. This post-war extraterritorial Nazi state had its fingers and hands in almost every shady post-war political deal that you can possibly think of. They helped Gamal Abdel Nasser into power in Egypt. They trained his army. They set up the Fedayeen and trained Muslim suicide bombers and terrorists.
And they were in control of the Muslim Brotherhood. Which,
yes, exactly.
Which we eventually got hold of and sent into Afghanistan in the 1980s and changed the name to Al-Qaeda, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a huge, huge story.
And, of course, you'll never read about this or hear about this in your corporate mass media because today the mass media is under the control of six corporations. And the one that really gets me is that with the exception of maybe two major publishers, every publishing house in the United States today is owned or controlled by Bertelsmann.
That's right.
Of Germany.
Of Germany.
which was the largest publisher of Nazi propaganda for the Wehrmacht
That's
in World
right.
War II.
That's right.
And then, we look around, you know, we just finally got rid of George W. Bush, whose grandfather was actually prosecuted under the Trading with the Enemies Act during the war for being a Nazi financial frontman. We've got Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, who has his father was a Nazi Gauleiter, a Nazi
That's
party
right.
leader. And for God's sakes, we've got Pope Benedict the 16th, the current Pope, who in 1944 was Joseph Ratzinger in Poland and a member of the Hitler Youth.
Right.
And it makes you wonder who won the war.
Well, that it does. That it does. Well, you know, to add one more coincidence to the story, the current Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, is a PhD in physics. So, you know, just pile that on top of everything else, you've got a pretty bleak picture.
It's just absolutely amazing. I don't even know what to think about this. And, you know, I told you about this when we were together the last time, and I came back and found the Fox News story. Last year in July, we have Henry Kissinger, who was born in Germany, over in Germany, presenting an award to George Herbert Walker Bush, the son of the Nazi financier, Prescott Bush, and praising him and because he said he was the person most responsible for the reunification of Germany.
Yeah, I know.
So here we have them all gathered over in Germany and praising, backslapping each other for the reunification of Germany, the Bushes and Henry Kissinger. And where did this little award ceremony take place? On the Von See.
That's
Joseph,
right.
Joseph, tell us the significance of the Von See.
Well, Von See, of course, was the site where they had the conference that finalized the plans for the final solution. In other words, the extermination of the Jews inside of Europe.
And now, do you really believe this is sheer coincidence?
Oh, of course not. You know,
this is the Nazi International at work and showing their hand, isn't
absolutely.
It?
You know, the whole German reunification itself, that's such a murky story that really people in this country don't even know anything about. You know, all we saw on TV
was the wall coming down.
Yeah, we're happy Berliners tearing down the wall.
Yeah, we.
But what people don't realize is all the events that led up to the reunification. For one thing, inside of the old East German Republic, there was a strong movement for reform, let's just put it that way, very similar to what you found in other Eastern Bloc countries.
Same thing was happening in Russia.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You had this pressure for reform, but not necessarily for, you know, reunifying with Germany, with West Germany. But the neo-Nazis started showing up at these rallies and changed the chants of the people that they were, you know, they were shouting, "Wir sind das Volk," we are the people. Well, the neo-Nazis showed up and they quickly steered these rallies to start chanting, "Wir sind ein Volk," we are one people. And in addition, they also used the good old-fashioned Nazi strong-arm tactics to literally physically intimidate or bludgeon people that expressed opposing points of view.
Same thing they had done in the 1920s.
Exactly.
To bring the Nazis to power.
Exactly. Now, you got to ask yourself, how is it in supposedly communist Eastern Europe, especially in the most communist state of them all, East Germany, do you get organized neo-Nazis able to pull this off? Well, my suspicion is that they were getting funding, and that's fairly conclusive now, that they were getting funding from the West German government and support from the German Bundesnachrichtendienst, their kind of version of the CIA. But here's the real thing, Jim. When the Berlin Wall came down, it came down on the anniversary not only of the Kristallnacht, the pogrom against the Jews in 1938, but it came down on that same day on the anniversary of the Nazi Beer Hall Putsch. So in other words, again, even the day that the wall came down was selected to be a significant Nazi anniversary.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but let me bring you right up to date, okay?
Sure.
We now have, of course, a new president, President Barack Hussein Obama.
Right.
And so in November, we have now apparently shifted from National Socialism to Marxist Socialism. In fact, a week or so ago, the Newsweek magazine had a big cover, and it said, "Now we are all socialists." So here we are, and Barack Obama's national security advisor is General James L. Jones,
mm-hmm.
And last month he addressed the Munich Security Conference over in Germany, at the Hotel Bayerischerhof.
Uh-huh.
And they had just honored Henry Kissinger,
yes.
of all people. And so our current national security advisor to President Obama gets up and starts his remarks by saying, "Thank you for that wonderful tribute to Henry Kissinger yesterday. Congratulations. As the most recent national security advisor of the United States, I take my daily orders from Dr. Kissinger."
Yep.
"Filtered down through General Brent Snowcroft and Sandy Berger, who is also here, we have a chain of command in the National Security Council that exists today." This is Jim Mars for Dreamland, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland Online with guest host Jim Mars.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars back again here on Dreamland with Joseph P. Farrell discussing the Nazi International. We still have the same people fronting for the Nazi International in charge, right?
That's basically right. That's basically my take. Exactly so. I think what we see, you know, I have an opinion about this current financial meltdown, and that is, if we go back to the early Bilderberg meetings, what we see there, as you pointed out in your book, Rise of the Fourth Reich, is that Prince Bernhard is an SS officer. He's a former vice president of IG Farben, and one of the early attendees that he manages to get invited to these Bilderberg meetings is precisely Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who is the CEO of Deutsche Bank. So I kind of speculate here as to why the Bilderberg meetings originally took place. And I think it was for the purpose of coordinating all of this financial capital, this liquid capital, that this Nazi International had in their hands, to get it into the Western corporate banks, the big New York and London banks, and then have that money turned right back around and funneled back into Europe, kind of laundered, as it were, to help rebuild Europe and position the European Union with Germany at the center of it. So I think that's exactly what's going on.
I think I tend to agree with you 100%. And so again, what we're saying here is that today the Nazis, the National Socialist, are not necessarily German, and they don't wear a swastika. In
right.
fact, today I think what we have is the more modern National Socialists. Well, for one thing, over in this country, they call themselves neocons, neoconservatives.
Right.
Okay,
right.
And they wear a little American flag pin, and instead of saying "Heil Hitler," they say "Have a nice day." Right. But the actions, their activities are absolutely the same, and it's absolutely amazing. Now, let me ask you this. And also, we now see that that this Nazi International is now encompasses the Western banking system, right?
Well, that's where we might disagree a little bit. I think, you know, if we go back to this original purpose, I think, behind the Bilderberg meetings, I think we have now evidence that there is genuine panic on the part of the Anglo-American banking elite. In other words, somebody has the gun to their head. And the only thing that I can find historically that would provide that kind of financial leverage against them would be precisely this Nazi International. And the reason I say that is because when we look at this Nazi International, what we're looking at is, first of all, an extraterritorial state around a solidly German core, but yet an international kind of fascism. But
right.
They have
not only control over finances, but now control over technology.
Well, that's precisely the thing. You know, if they've kept that independent research going for this amount of time, then yes, they've got their hand on a very powerful trigger. So I think that somebody has the gun to the Anglo-American corporate elite's head. And my suspicion is that one of the players now that is trying to vie for being the ultimate faction in control of this New World Order scheme is precisely this Nazi International.
Very interesting. So, in other words, it's kind of a case of the tail wagging the dog.
Exactly. Exactly.
But, of course, this is what happens when you get in bed with the Nazis, because you accept their largesse, you accept their technology, you're also going to get their philosophy.
You're going to get their philosophy, and like I say, the marker is going to come due someday. and you'd better be able to pay. You know, these are real Nazis we're dealing with here, folks.
These are not neo-Nazis. These
are the real old-fashioned kind of Nazis.
It's amazing. And of course, with the in their form of National Socialism as they practice it, what we see is, of course, fascism.
Exactly.
And the dictionary definition of fascism is the combination of state and corporate power.
That's right.
And this is exactly what we see happening today. Now,
right.
Let me ask you this, Joseph. The current economic meltdown, most thinking people agree that this has been contrived. Do you think this has been contrived by the Nazi International?
Well, I think that they are players. I think that there are a couple of other players that right now I'm not at liberty to say. I'm kind of writing a book on it, but I'll say this. From everything that I've researched thus far, I do think that there is an element, first of all, of some artificiality to this crisis. However, I don't think that the major players in contriving it are necessarily to be found in London and New York. I think you're going to find the major players in Europe, and I think you're going to find the major players in Asia.
Mm. Okay, well, now that brings us back to what kind of connection can you draw between the Nazis and Asia?
Well, there are several. One of the most famous is the old World Anti-Communist League that was headquartered in Taiwan. And this, if you investigate that long enough, you'll discover there are all sorts of connections to this post-war Nazi International. In fact, there are some direct contacts between that organization and General Reinhard Gehlen's old German military intelligence outfit, which you and I both know became kind of amalgamated into the CIA for a certain period of time after the war. So you find all of these kinds of connections with these anti-communist leagues, and in some cases you even find some overlap with some of the Oriental secret societies, and that's a whole other can of worms in itself.
Right. Well, I was going to say, isn't it also true that the Nazis in their worldwide quest for occult knowledge and science pushed all the way to Tibet and had contact with some of the Tibetan masters?
Absolutely. And that, I think, is the historical origin of some of that contact, absolutely.
Hmm. So what can we do about it today? What are your thoughts?
Well,
over and above, of course, just trying to educate ourselves and our fellow Americans as to what's really going on.
Well, you know, I get asked that question a lot, and I increasingly come to the position that we're going to have to take kind of the same tactic that was used in Eastern Europe to bring down the Soviet Union. In other words, we are going to have to accept the fact that in this country, at least, both of the major political parties are, for all intents and purposes, illegitimate because they are in the hands of this corporate elite. They do not really serve the public good, the American people, anymore. They don't really have any sort of allegiance to any of those ideals. So I think we're going to have to take the strategy that we have to command the culture. Let them have all the instrumentalities of government and military and so on, but we have to command the culture. And if that doesn't seem like a very effective strategy, just remember that it all started in Poland. And basically the approach there, largely through the Roman Catholic Church, was they could have everything except the culture. And, of course, communism collapsed.
Hmm. Very interesting. Now,
how
do we gain control over the culture?
Well, I think by doing precisely what we're doing. We're writing, we're talking, we're educating each other. And if we expand our activities, we eventually include art, we include various media, we include music, and so on and so forth. And we gradually infiltrate ourselves into all of those areas and begin to quite literally take command of the culture.
Well, that's really fascinating. I don't know if you're much of a movie goer, but you know, there's been some recent movies that really kind of present more truth than you get off of the corporate control mass media.
That's right.
So, what is your general take now on? Well, I think we've already got that. The Nazi International now is kind of at least trying to wag the dog.
Well, I think to a certain extent, yes, but my suspicion, Jim, is that it's much more powerful in Europe than we could possibly imagine. For example, the National Democrat Party inside of Germany, which is basically nothing but a neo-Nazi party, is poised to make some rather substantial gains in local elections inside of Germany. And if you look at the German military, and this to me is just the most fascinating story of them all, and I predicted this, you know, my friends will kind of vouch for me here that go way back, you know, with me, is that when the Berlin Wall came down, I told everybody that was a close friend of mine that you watch. This means that the German military will start reviving all of those old Prussian military traditions.
And have you seen evidence of this?
Oh, absolutely. Jim, you can go on YouTube and search for German army parades, okay? And there's one in particular that just kind of sent chills up my spine. It's a kind of a military review drill show that they did in a stadium in Cologne in 2005, okay? And they come marching in, drums a-blazing, carrying the old ceremonial bell tree, and doing everything but the goose step. And when they leave the stadium, they go out singing one of those old German marching songs. The soldiers and sailors there are singing this thing as they leave. And the Germans are loving it.
It's kind of like an instant replay of the Nuremberg rallies.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You can go online and find modern YouTube videos of the modern German army doing its military tattoos by torchlight out in front of the old Reichstag in Berlin, with Angela Merkel herself sitting in, you know, in the VIP box watching all of this. Okay? So in other words, they are reviving all of these old traditions. And here's the real clincher, Jim. The first post-unification head of the German military, a fellow by the name of General Klaus Naumann, did two things. He not only insisted that all German military cemeteries in Eastern Europe acknowledge and take care of SS officers, okay? But if the Eastern Europeans didn't want to do that, and these are his own words, they shall have to have the screws put to them. Okay? And the second thing he did is he pressed for and he got the establishment of a 50,000 man strong mobile strike force for the German army. Now, if you stop and think about it, the population base of Germany is comparatively small, but it has one of the largest standing armies in the world and one of the best equipped. And now on top of that, we're adding a 50,000 man mobile strike force.
Which could go anywhere in the world.
Which can go anywhere, exactly.
Yes. Now, do you foresee any time in the future some sort of direct confrontation between this new Germany and the United States?
No, I really don't.
I don't either.
We're
part of it.
Well, not only that, but I think, again, we're seeing some serious signs of real factional infighting in this new world order. I don't think things are going all the way the Anglo-American faction, which has been leading this scheme for the last 100 years, has really wanted it to go. So it's going to be a very interesting next decade or so, because I think it's not going to play out exactly the way they want it to.
Amazing. Well, I believe our time's about up, and this has been so interesting that we haven't even broken for our breaks, so hopefully we can work all that in. But Joseph P. Farrell, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me back, Jim. I appreciate it.
Do you have any final thoughts on what you'd like to tell people regarding the Nazi International?
Well, I think the most important thing that people can do is educate themselves on the real history of World War II and the aftermath, because I think what we've been told for decades now is really just one gigantically huge lie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gee, you think they'd lie to us about important stuff like who killed Kennedy and who weapons of mass destruction?
I sure do.
Absolutely. Joseph Farrell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Mars, and you've been listening to a really extraordinary edition of Dreamland.